5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Josh Rogan, the Washington Post Global Opinions columnist, is also the author, Josh Rogan, of his new book, Chaos Under Heaven, Trump, Xi, and the Battle for the 21st Century. 2017 is the two opponents, the United States and China, deciding whether how they're going to go forward between the hawks, the super hawks, Wall Street, those who want a diplomatic solution to what appears to be a trade imbalance to the new president, President Trump. 2018, there are definitions that are necessary. What is a economic war? What is a tech war? What is national security? The principles are moving around. There are no clear lines, as we learn from Josh's chronology of 17 and 18. It is now early 2019. The relationship is breaking down, and there's a search for metaphors. Recall that there's always a search for the right thing. This from a quote that Josh uses, thanks to Matt Pottinger in his book, "If names cannot be correct, then language cannot be in accordance with the truth of things. And if language cannot be in accordance with the truth of things, then affairs cannot be carried on to success." The affairs between China and the United States are not clear at this point until you name the thing itself. Josh, is this a Cold War? Is that helpful in the year 2019 to think of it as a Cold War at the State Department and at the White House?
Thanks, John. You know, I argue in the book that the use of the term Cold War has been stretched beyond any real usefulness or any real constructive instruction on how we should think about what's going on between the U.S. and China. In short, it's been bastardized to the point of being totally misleading in the sense that what most people will tell you is that, oh, well, you know, we're headed towards a Cold War. We don't want a Cold War. Therefore, we should not confront Chinese government or any of its bad behavior. That's the typical Washington conventional wisdom. If you turn on your TV today or you listen to Henry Kissinger, that's the way that the term Cold War is used. And what I say in the book is that it's an imperfect analogy for a number of obvious reasons, but it's not a totally useless analogy. In other words, we're engaged in some sort of grand competition with China, and that's not just about, you know, soybeans and 5G. It's about ideology, and it's about politics, and it's about the world order, and it's about all of these fundamental things that we believe in and that our system and our order is based on. And we have to realize that the Chinese Communist Party just doesn't see it that way, and that they're trying to shape a world order that's more amenable to their interests. In other words, in a liberal world order where the things that they're doing are not confronted, including mass atrocities and all the rest. So, it's, you know, forget about the sort of, you know, false idea that a Cold War is something that we necessarily need to avoid or that this fits into that mold. It's useful in a sense in that we have a problem that's on the scope and the scale of the Cold War, but it's more of what I think people would refer to as a systems battle, right? And that systems battle is going to play out in a different way than it did with the Soviets. And of course, we're more integrated with China than we were with the Soviet Union. And of course, you know, this Cold War or systems battle or whatever you want to call it won't be primarily military. It won't be fought on military battlefields. It'll be fought in the economic, technological, and even ideological realms. So if you can wrap your head around like a slight bit of nuance, which is to say there are things we can learn from the Cold War, but that we can't overlearn those lessons, and that the use of the term Cold War has been weaponized in a sense to attack people who want to confront the China challenge. If you can keep those three ideas in your head, then we could have a discussion about what we can take from the Cold War and why it's also not the model for what we're seeing exactly.
In the minds of the government, of the administration officials in early 19, are events from 2018 that are not easily put together, but we can see them more clearly now. Let's begin with the demand by China that the word Taiwan be erased from airline websites, or the demand by China that Marriott fire one of its employees because he's used the word Taiwan, or the demand by China with these all strange remarks that the NBA interfere in the freedom of an American to speak out because that American has in some fashion shown support for the people of Hong Kong. These were incidents in everybody's mind in 2018. You've mentioned the Uyghurs already. Now, Josh, that's not Cold War thinking, but it's strange. Was there anyone organizing the fact that China is now telling us that our First Amendment is to be circumscribed because China demands it? Did they understand in Washington that China is no longer satisfied with its territorial integrity? It's going to edit the Constitution of the United States.
Well, that's exactly right. It's been dawning on various parts of American society quite slowly that China's efforts to control discussion about its actions are now extended way beyond its borders. And in China, they call this a social credit system. And that's not to say that, you know, you lose social credit for breaking the law. You lose social credit for going against the party, going against the party's political agenda. And Chinese people have been dealing with that for a long time. And what happened in 2018, but more actually in 2019, especially with the NBA case, was that China started to enforce that against American companies and American citizens and American companies, not knowing what to do and not having any real experience or guidance in how to fight the Chinese Communist Party's economic coercion, did pretty much the same thing each time, which is to fold and bow and scrape and beg for forgiveness and promise never to do it again. And when the U.S. government was sort of getting involved in these issues, especially with the NBA, what it would often do is to criticize the American companies. But, you know, sort of what I argue in the book is that these companies were victims of the Chinese Communist Party's coercion tactics and that they didn't really have any idea or any resources to confront or protect themselves. So, we have this sort of awareness now that, oh, wait, when the Chinese government punishes the NBA for one tweet and the punishment is in the hundreds of millions of dollars, something's wrong there, right? Most Americans can sort of look at that and say, oh, my God, like, we can't have that. We can't have the Chinese Communist Party telling us what not to tweet, and they're going to, you know, punish an entire industry over it. At the same time, the U.S. government really hasn't come through with any good solutions or any real partnerships. So I think that's a huge gap in our policy. But the fact is that when the Chinese Communist Party starts exporting its punishments, that sort of puts the lie to the argument that it's not trying to enforce its ideology.
The Confucius Societies, the Confucius Clubs. In 2019, I believe, Josh, you at George Washington University, your alma mater, you join a Confucius Institute sponsored Chinese language class, and you discover that you're not being influenced. But the Confucius Societies, how do they function on American campuses at that time?
Right. And again, this is a case by case issue that's very difficult to talk about, much less confront. And when I joined the GW Confucius Institute Chinese class, there were just a bunch of people learning Chinese, and I didn't witness any malign influence activities. But at the same time, as I was reporting on this issue, I got calls from, you know, people in different schools, FBI agents, professors, students, who actually did see very clear examples of these institutes being abused for the purposes of Chinese Communist Party influence advancement in a number of ways. And some, you know, in Washington, D.C., it's you know, you don't really need to use the Confucius Institute to do your espionage. But in a place like Western Florida, for example, well, that's a place where, like, you know, the Confucius Institute becomes a really good place to hide a couple of spies. And then, you know, in other campuses, like in UC San Diego, well, they just protest against the Dalai Lama coming until the Dalai Lama can never come to your school again. And, you know, there's a range of different ways that student organizations on campus are used and abused by their local consulates and by the Chinese government to shut down the freedom of speech for Chinese students on campus and for American students on campus. And again, that's not to say that, like, we shouldn't celebrate Chinese student organizations, but we also have to be clear-eyed about when they're being abused and when they're being funded by, you know, Communist Party influence organizations. And it happens all the time, as it turns out.
You make the very helpful point that U.S. institutions are accustomed to being independent, not seeking Washington's
right.
help. Did they come to understand at the time that there was a common theme here and that they needed something larger? Did they call the FBI?
Right. Well, this is the same thing we saw with the NBA and the same thing I've seen with the Wall Street firms. And this is really one of the main themes of the book, is that, you know, when the FBI comes to knocking on your door, that's not always the best interaction for if you're a university or a Silicon Valley tech company or a Wall Street firm. And the distrust between the U.S. government and a lot of American institutions, parts of American society, is like well established and well earned. And we can't do what the Chinese side does, which is, you know, the government or the party comes in, they tell everybody what to do, and everybody just does it. Right? Our system doesn't work that way. So, you know, I think that, you know, over time, again, mistakes have been made, but the national security community and academia have started to work constructively on how to deal with this common problem. And in Silicon Valley, it hasn't gone that well, and in Wall Street, it's gone even worse. And, you know, some of it is that these institutions rightly protect their independence, and some of it is that some of those elites are compromised or corrupt, and it's hard to know which is which. And it's also true that when the FBI gets involved, they don't always do it perfectly, you know, and mistakes are made. So this is all part of the awakening that we all have to sort of get our heads together on, which is that, you know, the presence of malign foreign influence in our institutions is a shared problem, and we have to come up with some shared solutions that don't go overboard and that don't target Chinese or Chinese Americans disproportionately, but at the same time, we can't ignore this problem anymore because it's showing up everywhere we look.
The book is Chaos Under Heaven, Trump, Xi, and the Battle for the 21st Century. Josh Rogan is the author. When we come back, Josh mentions Wall Street, but there's much to learn about how Wall Street has a mixed record towards investment in China. Also, what is the Thousand Talent Plan? I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show.
This is the new Weight Watchers, built for real life and real results, no matter what mode you're in. Maddie went all in for her big day and lost 33 pounds. Emily lost 85 pounds and hit her goal while still living her life.
Weight Watchers gave me the tools and I feel amazing.
Join the millions of members and lose weight with the number one doctor-recommended weight loss program.
I'm able to live my life and still hit my goals.
Lose more at WeightWatchers.com. Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s. It works for members like...
I'm Haley, and I've lost 100 pounds. Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects. It's all in one place.
Weight Watchers handles the insurance for you and offers affordable cash pay options. With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
I'm Mike, and I've lost 135 pounds. Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
I'm Sharia, and I lost 80 pounds on Weight Watchers. I realized that it would take more than a prescription to lose weight and feel good on a GLP-1.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last.
I can't imagine doing a GLP-1 without Weight Watchers.
Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com/GLP-1. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now, it's your turn. Weight Watchers. Watch it work.